Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Xuan Juliana Wang, author of Home Remedies, her first collection of short stories, and it was published in May by Hogarth. Xuan's writing has appeared in, The Atlantic, Plowshares, Pushcart, The Best American Non-Required Reading, those anthologies that I have in my bookstore. She's fiction editor at Fence. She moved here to the States in Los Angeles around when she was 7 years old, and she teaches at UCLA. So Home Remedies is a collection of stories that seemingly are disparate, but in many ways, not because they tell Chinese stories, but because they actually are not disparate. They're linked together in a way that, you know what, I can't really articulate. At first, they may seem like totally alien to us, to our lives, our culture, but upon reflection or a second reading, the parallels in thought, emotion, empathy, or lack thereof, and action become exceedingly familiar. So whether it's abandoned children, Walnut, Pine Tree, and Lucy, which, see, it's alien, who may not really be abandoned, to singers with mohawks, rich kids who have nothing to do but cruise, do drugs, and pretend to make music videos, which is definitely not alien, or hucksters, maybe, maybe not, who long for awe, wonder, and acceptance. They allow these characters, oftentimes unhappy or uncertain, to have this arc, this one story specifically, this arc of space and time that sometimes is measured in milliseconds and sometimes in years. So without further, as usual with me, obfuscation and droning, welcome, Xuan. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sam, for the amazing summary of my book.
Who knows? I never quite know if it's right or not. So, you know, many times in books, and I say this a lot, I rely on an epigraph to suggest to me a theme, but there's not an epigraph here, at least not one that I can read. But the cover, which is, I think, sublime, gives us a kind of mysterious portent of what is to come. So, like, with the cover, did you design it? Did you vet it? Did you approve it? Do you love it?
I'm so glad you asked. I chose the photograph for the cover.
Oh, cool.
The photographer's name is, his name is Number 223. which is a reference to a Wong Kar-wai's Chungking Express, where the lovelorn cop has, that's his pager number. So the photographer is, you know, it's my age, and he is from Beijing, and I knew him through, I knew his work, and I also, like, got connected to him through mutual photographer friends from China. And I love that, I love the image. I thought it was so evocative. And I think there's something quite sexy about that image, and I think what I loved about his photos in general is that it's Chinese youth. It's about just being young, and I wanted it on my cover.
Did you, when you say you picked, when you chose the picture of the girl, the hair, is that someone?
Yes.
Is that somebody you know, or is it, was it just a, like a, not a stock photo, but somebody else, or?
No, it's like, it's one of, just like one of his works. Like, I saw it on his website, and then I just wrote to him on WeChat to ask him if I could use it.
Oh, WeChat, right. Photo. WeChat figures prominently in your book, and it's something that's kind of semi-alien to us, too. That's cool.
Yeah, I feel like WeChat, everything is happening on WeChat. Like, you know. Like,
yeah, I mean, I read this article about how there isn't any cash at all in China, you know? It's just, even if you're buying a banana, there's no cash involved. And it's,
yeah,
you guys are so ahead of us in so many ways, and like we were talking about before the show, yet you still kind of emulate us in some ways too. But anyway, what I was going to say was, as you may know, I have an independent bookstore, and everybody says, You can't judge a book by its cover. But unless someone's coming in for a specific book, everybody who comes in judges the books by their cover. And that's why publishers are smart, because they pick really good covers. And this one is one that you're obviously drawn to. And from experience in the store, people are drawn to it. So anyway, I thought I'd tell you that. So why did you take your title from one of your stories, which kind of is like an epigraph in a way, actually? So why did you decide that story would be your gnomon of sorts?
I think whenever people used to ask me what my stories were about, I just used to say people with various problems. And I think, I mean, I got the title for the that story because at the time I was thinking about all the pharmaceutical commercials I used to watch when I was a little kid and how they were so soothing to me, because I was just, you know, when we immigrated, I was just at home a lot watching TV, and I used to see that there were so many terrible things that could happen to you, but then there were so many drugs that could kind of solve them. And I just I love that feeling. And I wanted to write a story in that tone. I think in some ways, I think of this book as just a collection of people with various problems that are not life-threatening. And these are the somewhat solutions I have for those problems.
You know, when I read the story, I was thinking about my father and our dog, Putney. And I was thinking that I think my father loved that dog more than he loved me. And when he put him to sleep, he was so bereft, and he wouldn't let anyone go with him, and he was just so sad. And I always wondered about that. I kind of loved him more because of it, but I kind of wondered why we were more important. You know?
It's easier to have a relationship with somebody that doesn't speak, I think.
Well, it's someone who gives you unconditional love, too, right? You know?
Yeah.
There's no questions about it. Oh, which reminds me. So, why do you like listing things as if there are, you know, things to do, how you should act in a given situation? And you kind of do the same thing in algorithms. Where do your lists come from? How do you come up with those lists?
I think I actually write lists quite often. Since I was 16, I kept a journal. And I still keep one. And I think a lot of the events that I like to track my emotional progression through everyday events in a list. And it just seems to come naturally for me.
That's like what James Joyce did in the Night Town episode of Ulysses. Mm-hmm. He just kind of listened to people at a bar. I do that too. I write it down. Sometimes it's better than a book, you know?
Yeah. I feel like I track, I think the thing with journals is that I get to track how I feel about situations and real life events, like in that moment. And sometimes when I need to write a character that's, you know, 17 and graduating from high school, I just go back to the journal and try to see what I was feeling at that time.
That's great, especially if you're assiduous about it, which it sounds like you were, because I read an interview. I think it was that 10 questions interview. And
Yeah,
and you were talking about how you just, the next morning usually. That's the other thing. Oh, yeah, one of the reviews. Well, they talked about different things. One of the reviews dealt with immigration, which I thought was wrong. And one of the reviews dealt with imagination. So I had this picture of you, with your head in one hand, looking out the window, kind of wondering, you know, is that what you do? Do you kind of just daydream and then it comes in and then you go, oh, my journal, like that?
Oh, no. I actually find that I was just thinking of how before this interview, I was in a coffee shop just staring at people and writing notes. I always think of, maybe this is a result of immigration, of kind of being, I felt quite invisible for most of my life in the States. You know, it wasn't until China became a major, economic player that people started to pay attention to Chinese immigrants, I think. I feel like, because I speak Chinese, I also observe Chinese people, I just think of this my life is just a, I'm just a blob in the background observing people in situations, and I'm writing them down almost as jokes to myself, or like the stories I'm telling myself as I just try to, you know, get on with my life.
That's kind of cool, having both of those viewpoints, because most people don't. You know,
I find that, I think that having two languages is one of the most amazing gifts a writer can have, because I'm always trying to find the reason why we say things in one language and another language, and there's so many just innate stories in that already.
Yeah, it's like Vladimir Nabokov, you know, it's like he spoke English, he wrote English better because he knew Russian so well.
Yeah.
Amazing, and you know, it was obviously an amazing writer, but you could just feel that there was this undertone that made what he was writing better than you could write if you just knew English and not another language, be that as it may. Oh, so
I think,
go ahead.
I also think it helps you feel more. I find that it intensifies my feeling towards situations. I worry about people that don't, you know, that only have one language.
So what do you do when you dream, when you think? When do you think and dream in Chinese?
I remember the moment that I said a spontaneous word out loud in English without, you know, when I was just learning English. I was like, oh, I'm saying it. It's just coming to me in English. But I think what it gives me is this sense of empathy towards, you know, people that on the street that are speaking Chinese, or I think the way that they're saying something, there's like another kind of the music and the beauty of what they're saying and the language that they're saying in, it makes me feel deeper about this person and this situation.
My son's first word was McDonald's, which still really irritates me. So the other night, it was really weird. I was watching male synchronized swimming, and the next day I read your story, Vaulting the Sea. And so in my life, I think there's certain things that are kind of like impossible. So like one is when I looked at the pyramids and I go, what the hell? This is impossible. You know, what, aliens? What? I mean, this cannot be. And the other one is the Sagrada Familia Church by Gaudi in Barcelona that's still being built after 200 years. I mean, I look at it and I go, no, this is not possible. And then I was just in Florence, and I, for many times, looking at David, and he's alive.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy's alive.
Yes.
And then you look at, if you turn to the, go to the side and you look at him looking at Goliath, and he's like going, man, there is no way you are going to kick my ass. I mean, you have absolutely no chance. And it's those things to me are like impossible. And then that's what I was thinking when I was thinking of, they'll get the pronunciation wrong, but Taiyoku and Hai. And it was just like, and you say it because you say milliseconds. It's impossible, right? How do you do that? And what made you use that as a kind of metaphor?
What made me use milliseconds as a kind of metaphor?
Well, that alone, or just that sport, and the idea of over the years how you get to the point where you recognize each other's breath and know exactly, when, you know, that kind of thing.
I feel like I felt exactly the same way when I saw David. This is amazing. I remember watching a lot of synchronized diving in Beijing because I was living there at the time. And then I was just really inspired by a television interview with these two young boys. And it's just like, it was just the way that they were looking at each other and talking to each other. And I just saw it on the TV. It just filled me with all of this. I feel like the story just came to me. And then I started to think about synchronized swimming for the next 5 years, synchronized diving for the next 5 years. I watched so many interviews. and I watched the, you know, the next Olympics came around, and I watched all these synchronized divers, again, all of their interviews, the way they talk and the way they get out of the water. And I think I just was able to intuit that there's so much room for longing and unrequited love. And even though I've never been a synchronized swimmer, I know about unrequited love, you know? And I think there's, I just wanted to imbue their actions with the feelings that I was familiar with.
Yes, it's unrequited, but it's not quite unrequited. And that's what makes it kind of a tragedy. And the other thing that makes it a tragedy, which I got pissed off at you about, was I was hoping so much that they would win the gold medal. I mean, I was sure they were going to win. And I go, oh.
Maybe in the next book.
Yeah. but yeah, that was what you did was great. But, you know, I was thinking, you know, there's not too many happy people in the book. But if I'm pronouncing his name right, he was happy. He was happy the whole time, except you don't know if in the very, very last moment what he's feeling.
Yeah.
And that's what's key to it, you know. There's an empty space, and you don't know how he responds to that. That was a really good story.
Thank you.
So how do you pronounce Fuerdai? Fuerdai?
Oh, it's Fuerdai.
Fuerdai. Yeah, so that's okay, so what we're talking about is this Chinese thing that's this disdain, not for the nouveau riche, which happens, you know, like in Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt or Main Street or something like that, but it's a disdain for the second generation, the kids of the nouveau riche. Is that, do you think that's mirrored in America now, or do you think it's primarily your cultural reference? I don't know the answer. Go ahead.
You know the answer?
I don't know the answer.
I feel like the, you know, Fuerdai is kind of a very established concept in Chinese culture. I'm sure there's the equivalent in every culture. It's just that because of what's currently happening now in, you know, in world economics, that this is the children of nouveau riche have kind of a unsurpassed buying power, and then they're making themselves known because of people want to sell them things. I think I was really interested because that's so much a part of what my parents and like the Chinese people I know were talking about. And when I go back to every time I go back to China, I feel like I have a new I see more and more of young Chinese people with so much money and so much power that, you know, a generation of before, like when I was around, didn't exist.
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking of the one scene where they see the Americans who are kind of self-conscious of the fact that they've just adopted a Chinese baby, and everyone's saying or thinking sarcastically, oh, how lucky he is. And when my ex-wife and I went over to China and adopted our two daughters the second time,
yeah,
I went by myself because it was the height of the SARS epidemic, and I went to Guangzhou, and my ex-wife packed like 300 masks. And when I got there, nobody was wearing a mask, so I just kind of left them in the suitcase. And then I ended up playing badminton and handing Annie off to this old lady, and I'm thinking, what am I doing? I just can't hand her off. But I really wanted to kick these guys' asses in badminton, which I did. And but in Xi'an, we went to see the terracotta soldiers, and she got her picture taken with the farmer who doesn't have to work anymore and sat in this little lawn chair. And but I remember all these women gathering around me, and I was kind of scared because it was like, you know, it was like when someone wins the World Cup and everyone gathers around you and you think that guy's going to get hurt. And they were all gathered around me, and they were all telling me that I didn't have enough clothes on Annie. that she needed more. It was like 80 degrees out. Well, Guangzhou is like you walk outside and you're just soaking wet. And
yes.
But they wanted me to put more clothes on her. I have no idea what this is apropos to. I'm just telling you a story.
All Chinese people are worried about people being cold. That is, you have noticed, you have picked out a truism.
Yeah, it was so funny. Because I thought, you know, they wanted to swaddle her with like three blankets. And, you know, then they get mad at me. And the other thing I noticed, in China is like, I thought everybody was angry at each other. Because they were loud, and I thought they were screaming at each other, and then I realized they were just having a conversation. But it took me a while. I thought we were going to get into fights.
Sometimes they are yelling at each other. I think it's just a lot of people and not enough resources. Just have to make sure that you're, you know, nobody cuts in front of you in line. You know?
Oh, yeah. Well, so going back to the book, because we want to try and sell it. So, and for our children, you know, you have an arranged marriage, but one that could easily occur in our country, you know, well, they do occur, and they do occur in reverse, too. So, just like in the way you answered the other question about the synchronized swimming, what occurred in your mind that you thought, okay, here's something that could happen? A really rich woman who has a child that has, without spoiling anything, a difference, wants to make sure that she's taken care of, but also wants to make sure that, a bunch of things. So, was that something that you had experienced secondhand, or was it something that was like derived whole cloth, just out of your mind?
Well, I think with that story, I was really trying to write three sympathetic characters. I really wanted these people in a situation that would seem like, you know, each was having nefarious purposes, intentions. Well, seemingly nefarious intentions are actually all just sympathetic and good. And I think I put them in the situation. I tried to kind of empathize my way into these characters and then make the reader kind of see all of them as human people just trying to do their best. That was my intention for that story. I think this also underlies a lot of the reason why I tried to write is I think, you know, the very first stories I wrote about were based on people I know. So it would be, working class uncles, like, you know, the people I've grown up with, who I feel like will never be, their stories are just going to go nowhere unless somebody writes about them, writes their humanity and has that appear, like, be able to draw out their humanity so that readers can see them as humans.
It's interesting. It's interesting that you say. I was going to say it's interesting that you see all three of them as being good people, because
I want them to.
Well, okay. So, how do you pronounce Jiao?
Jiao.
Okay.
Oh God.
So that was close. So, but he has these dreams of doing things after he gets married that might be considered, not so nice, really. And then, and then Beverly is, you know, it's a world that revolves around money, but Melanie is like not like an angel, but she's very innocent and she's got nothing in her but good, even though from the outside world, like Xiao's friend who's such a jackass says that word that shuts everybody up. But I liked Melanie a lot.
But the other two,
well, Beverly was just kind of like objective, very pragmatic. She didn't have any mean motives, but she knew what she wanted. Well, she knew what she wanted about everything, and she got it. And she worked hard to get it. But Zhao, you know, he did some weird things before, you know, just like slapping the willow branches and things like that. Oh, which reminds me, there's things in this book that are really weird, like pigeons. birds, bees, dreams. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay. And some of the stories end with that. They end with those things that you wouldn't think. And and then I'm like thinking, what the hell did she end it that way for? And then you kind of think about it, especially the bees. And it really does resonate. And I, once again, it's another thing I can't really articulate. But I wonder again, and I don't know if this is the best way to interview someone, but I wonder again, like, so the bees, did they just come into your mind, or you say, okay, this will dovetail nicely into mm-hmm. this? Because they're kind of like epigraphs in a way.
Yeah, I think it's actually a through line through most of my stories, right? There's whales and other stories. And there's missing airplanes. And I think, I actually think this has something to do with the way I have been told stories growing up from family. Maybe it's like a more of a Chinese oral tradition, or there's always an element of something that you can't control or explain that comes in. You know, like Chinese literature has a lot of fantasy, and there's always some element that's inexplicable, even in somebody's retelling of, I don't know, like getting their car towed or something. And I feel like in my daily life, I always find that there's something that I'm interested in that really has no real, like no direct bearing on the life, on my everyday life, that guides me or makes me, I don't know, that makes my life more interesting. So I think that the section with the bees came very naturally to me in that story. And also I think I'm using these elements to say something, to give another layer of another layered story to the lives of the people in the story. I don't know. I feel like there's something out there for somebody to interpret that maybe has more of an understanding of Chinese culture.
Yeah. Well, that one.
Also, I feel like I write these stories with these elements, and then, you know, right before, in my editing process, I'm always switching them around in places. Like I'm moving them around the story to see where they would have the most emotional impact.
Hey, I think you're culturally misappropriating. Because are you acting like that doesn't happen to Americans? I mean, I have seminal dreams that I know shaped my life, and they're mythical, like the dream that he has. And I know that I can never forget them, and I know that they'll either come true or they already have, which is kind of horrific at times and then kind of beatific at times. But
yes.
I think that's a unique.
Yes. But yes. I think maybe I was trying to explain something that I didn't need to explain.
Yeah, it's like my daughter, you know, I thought I knew what a meme was, and now apparently a meme is anything. So it's like, so once it's there, it's a meme, and it's really crazy. And so, like, I do think of some of these things in my own warped brain as like memes. Like, these are, like, in the Jungian sense, like, these are archetypical, you know? Like that dream, you know, and I'm not going to spoil it with what she has anatomically, but just the dream of the woman. And I remember, like, when I was 3 years old, I had this dream of this beautiful woman, and she was in this gossamer kind of diaphanous gown, and she was holding a little boy in one hand and a little girl in the other hand. And I have no idea what it means, but I know it means something in my life. It's like... Mm. It's kind of like that, right?
Yeah.
Which also goes to my next totally, I don't know, off-the-wall question, is like, okay, so these stories are, and if you've listened to my podcast, I always say this, they're not wrapped up. They're not put in a box. And there's not wrapping paper on them. And they're not tied with a bow. And some people love to read that stuff. And in all the book clubs we have, there's always fights because some people go, well, what happened? How are you supposed to know what happened next? And and they want it done. They want, okay, this is it. This is what happened. She's happy forever. They're unhappy forever. He's going to move on, whatever. And it's done. And all of these, all of your stories do not do that at all. Everyone leaves it up to the reader. And so, like, what I would ask would be, okay, you're done. Took you a long time to write these stories. Then you get them published, and then they're out there in the world. So, like, what do you think? Yeah. I mean, do you feel like, okay, I'm like really kind of torn because these were my stories, and now they're out there, and people can think whatever they want to think about them. Are you happy about that? Would you rather it be wrapped up more tightly?
Oh, that's an interesting question. In my mind, I thought I wrapped them up very tightly. I think this is how I feel like I guided the reader in a direction that I wanted them to feel, which is, I don't know, I think there is a kind of a sense of melancholy at the end of both of these stories. And I think this is maybe how I see life. This is, you know, a series of compromises with well-meaning people, and there's lots of moments of joy, and really funny things happen. And in the end, like, you know, there are no like triumphant endings to any, you know, to real life either. So to me, I think this is, I feel like I wrapped it up, and I gave an ending to every story.
No way. I mean, he's eating glass. You don't know really whether he's bleeding badly or not. Now I'm spoiling things. And then that's it. He goes away. And then, okay, well, what happens? Does he keep trying? Does he give up? Does he just kind of like, is that it for him? You know? And then like with One Diver, people still recognize him. Okay. They still recognize him. So what's he doing? And what's he going to do? Is he done? I mean, just because you're done with him, I'm not done with him.
I thought he was done with that part of his life, and he's moving on to other preoccupations.
Yeah, what? I mean, actually, you make it very clear. This is the first time in his life he's been able to decide for himself, and he makes that decision on the platform. And then his life is changed irrevocably, and so is the life of his partner. But I still think it's up to me. That's what I was getting at. And you're thinking exactly the opposite. It's weird.
Yeah, and I think for the glass eater, I feel like his role in the story was to change the life of the little girl.
Oh, yes. And she was his protector.
Yeah.
Which was interesting.
She realizes something irrevocably, something changes for her irrevocably, and then now she can live a different life because she met him.
Yeah. Maybe it's just me. Who knows? But, well, it's like the end of... for our children. So, like, I can't say it because I'll be spoiling it. Like, the last line of that story. You know, sometimes I'm talking to authors, and I realize the readers have no idea what I'm talking about. I mean, the listeners have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about
stories. This is amazing.
Why?
I rarely get to talk to someone who has read the stories. I love that about your interviews. I think they're, you know, you obviously have a personal connection and relationship with this work, and it's really nice to talk to you about it.
I figure it's really stupid not to read the book. I mean, it's like, not to put her down, but like Terry Gross, I mean, I don't want to ask questions like she asked. They're just all softball questions, and she has that voice, and then her questions go on for like 20 minutes. And you'll probably be interviewed by her.
No.
You will be.
I love this. I love that.
You know what's going to happen? You're going to get optioned for a Netflix series, and they're going to do the first season, which is going to be each story, and they're going to run out of stories, and then they're going to start making up their own, and you're going to get all pissed off.
Wow. Thank you. I hope this prophecy comes true.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. Okay. So, I see what you're saying. And I see, we're going off in different tangents. You're saying this story is about the little girl and how this man comes into her life. And you know what? I mean, the idea of this tiger at the end, yeah, come on. Because if the tiger at the end, you're telling the story of what he really did. And he did it on purpose.
Yes.
So you are still letting him hang out. I mean.
Yeah.
I'm.
He played an important role.
Well, that's what this whole question is about. Okay, so you let it go out there. I misinterpret it. Do you actually think I'm misinterpreting it, or do I have the...
No, I don't. You have free rein to interpret it.
So I have license to do whatever I want with your story, and you don't get upset.
No, I don't. I think I try to draw these characters. I try to make every character as real and as human and as interesting and, you know, alive as I could. And I let them... you know, interact. I let them have a relationship with each other on the page, and then whatever feelings that gives you, I feel that I'm interested not so much as like what you take away from the ending, but I think there's a particular ache in every story that I want to come across. And I think when readers, you know, if they feel invested enough at the end to want to know what happened to these people, then I feel like they've gotten what I wanted to them to get out of it, which is to just really fully understand somebody so different than themselves.
It's interesting that you use the word ache, because like I said, there's not really a lot of happy people here. And
but they're funny.
Yeah. But so are you going to write about happy people?
I think everybody is just seeking happiness, you know?
Yeah, well, that's not really an answer. I mean, do you have the capability? Do you feel like you
write about happiness?
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like I always think the people that are the least emotionally available to me are the ones that I'm most interested in. So I find myself being attracted to writing about people with, you know, problems.
Yeah. Well, these are all people in your head, and you're saying you're emotionally attracted to them because they're unavailable.
Yeah.
So that's a good, that's an interesting question. You choose to create people who are inaccessible to you.
Yeah, they're somewhat inaccessible, but they're more interesting.
Well, it's like going back to Michelangelo, you know, next to the David are those captives, you know, there's six captives.
Yes.
And you know how he said, you know, I don't really do anything. I just carve away what isn't the guy. You know?
Oh, yes.
So that's kind of what you're doing, I think. I think.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe, I think, maybe, you know, in in my next collection, written over the next 10 years of my life, maybe my outlook will change.
So what do you do when you teach? What are you teaching?
I teach a creative writing, I teach, you know, a fiction workshop, and I also teach contemporary Asian American literature.
Do you, in your fiction workshop, are you able to divorce yourself from the concept of Asian literature? Are you able to just, So do you like...
Most of my students, I mean, I'm because you know UCLA is a public institution in LA, and I grew up 20 minutes east of downtown. I feel like I'm very, very close to where my students come from. I understand how you know, most of them came to English from a second language, usually. Half the students are Hispanic. and every, I don't know, I feel very, very close to them. Like, as if I'm teaching, I feel that I know, like, where they went to high school, and I know what drives them to want to write, and I know how difficult it is for them to just even take a creative writing class. So I think it's been a really profoundly moving experience for me to teach these classes, because I think maybe this is the only creative writing class you're ever going to take. So I try to kind of do a lot of technique, and then I'm trying to figure out what aches from their stories and trying to help them, you know, be able to tell that story in a way that readers will want to read.
Right. And that's true. Now I understand about the ache, because when you have the luxury not to have aches, well, you know, that's not true either. I mean,
no,
everybody has them. You could be really rich, or you could have the best friends. And yeah, a lot of your characters are in that situation. And as far as teaching's concerned, I don't know how many years you've been doing it, but it's really hard to be idealistic that long. I know my other ex-wife, I have kind of a, not a collection, but then both of them are still friends. But my other ex-wife taught for 30 years in Florida, and she was incredibly idealistic, and she never lost it. And at the end, because it's Florida, she was making like $75,000 a year after 30 years of teaching. And she still cared about every student. And the problem was, as towards the end, students need a hug, kids need a hug. And now you can't hug them anymore.
Yeah.
You can't touch them. But they need a hug.
Yeah. Right.
So do you think you'll have the resolve to stay idealistic in this?
I don't know. I feel like I think to me right now, teaching feels like I'm doing volunteer work or something.
Right. Right.
Like the amount of compensation and time I put in has nothing, there's no correlation.
Right.
Which is fine, I think. Because I know, I grew up in a working class neighborhood, half Latino, half Asian, and I don't think I'm the only person in my high school graduating class that wanted to do something artistic, you know. And I feel like it was so difficult for me to get here, to be able to spend so much of my life trying to learn how to tell stories, and then to be able to publish a collection and to be able to have people read it. I feel like I need to give back, you know, so I think that's where my impulse to teach comes from.
Cool. That's a good place to end it, because we're combining both what you do and what you do. And I'm looking forward to what's coming next. I'll probably be dead by then. It's going to be another 10 years.
I have a novel coming out.
Oh, cool.
I'm
that's great. Well, so I'll end it with this. If you're ever around outside of Philadelphia, come by and see us. And if you're ever like at the Philadelphia Free Library or something like that, and you want to do two jobs in one day, come out and sign and read for us. That would be great. Or Skype in for one of the, it'll definitely be a book club pick. And so, yeah, you could Skype in for that too. That would be great.
I would love to. This is so great. I love talking to you.
Yes, I really enjoyed it too, and I love getting into the stories, like you said. It's fun to do. That's why I do it. So thank you so much, and thank you, Siouan, for writing Home Remedies, your first collection of short stories, and hopefully we'll talk again.
Yes, I hope so too.
Okay.
Thank you, Sam.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. So, we were talking with Siouan Juliana Wine and her debut collection of short stories is widely available. It was published by Hogarth. We have it in the bookstore. It has this absolutely beautiful cover. Not that you should judge it by that, but it just, she doesn't have an epigraph in the book, so the cover kind of acts as the epigraph. And it's, like I said to her, sublime. So, yeah, anyway, she was a pleasure talking to, and she's writing a novel, so hopefully we'll get to talk to her again. So upcoming, we have Arkady Martin, and her latest book is called, she's so smart, smartest, maybe the smartest person I've ever talked to. Her latest book is called A Memory Called Empire. It's a science fiction, they say, space opera, but it's really not that. It's a story about a galactic empire, how it works culturally, how its culture mirrors ours, and how much we can learn from that. And then Clara Lombardo joins us to discuss what seems to be like a really highly anticipated debut novel called The Most Fun We Ever Had. And then, as always, if you want a complete list, or if you want to do as Angie in my bookstore says, Throwback Thursday, just take a look on iTunes at one of our older interviews. I mean, like, I've interviewed David Mitchell, the guy who wrote Cloud Atlas. I've interviewed him three times now. His next book will come out in 2020, and hopefully, well, I'm pretty sure he'll talk to us again. So there's tons of them on iTunes, over 400 of them, enough to cure your insomnia if you listen to me over and over again. And as always, thank you for stopping by this time, and we look forward to having you here to listen again next week on The Avid Reader.